Michael, how are you?
I found something really interesting.
The whole housing market is propped up on these bad loans. They will fail.
The housing market is rock solid.
It's a time bomb.
So Mike Burry, who gets his hair cut at Supercuts and doesn't wear shoes, knows more than Alan Greenspan.
Dr. Mike Burry, yes, he does.
You know what? I'm pissed off. American people are getting screwed by the big banks.
And I am getting madder and madder.
It's unbelievable.
Then this guy walks into my office and says,
there's some shady stuff going down.
All the banks were having a big old party. A few outsiders saw what no one else could.
The whole world economy might collapse.
I'm sure the world's banks have more incentives than greed.
You're wrong.
No one's paying attention.
The banks got greedy. And we can profit off of their stupidity.
You want to bet against the banks?
I think we're either high or having a stroke. Kind of brilliant.
Fraud has never, ever worked. Eventually, things go south. When the hell did we forget all that?
How can the banks let this happen?
It's fueled by stupidity.
But that's not stupidity, that's fraud.
Tell me the difference between stupid and illegal, and I'll have my wife's brother arrested.
You have any idea what you just did? You just bet against the American economy.
If you're wrong, you can lose it all. The banks and defraud of the American people. Now we can kick them in the teeth.
Okay, here we go.
You target strippers.
With bad loans.
Mm-hmm.
No cash rich.
I'm not going to be able to refinance.
On all my loans?
What do you mean, all your loans?
I have 5 houses. And a condo.
Welcome back to the podcast, friends. You are tuned into the Film Literature and the New World Order podcast from CorbettReport.com, and I'm your host, as always, James Corbett. And this month, as you may have guessed, we are talking about The Big Short, the 2015 feature film from director Adam McKay of Anchorman and Anchorman 2 fame, an interesting choice for a director for a movie on a complicated financial subject. But in some ways, maybe it makes sense. It does certainly lend itself to a more entertaining style of film than you would expect from such a potentially dry, boring, or complicated subject. And I think we can all agree, if you have seen this movie, and I hope you have, that it is not dry or overly complicated. I think it makes its point fairly well, and surprisingly well. So we're going to dissect this movie, what it does well, and, of course, the parts of the story that it leaves out. But in order to do that, let's talk to someone who knows a thing or two about this story, and that is Robert Wenzel, who is the author and publisher of the Economic Policy Journal at economicpolicyjournal.com, and he's also the author of an interesting book, The Fed Flunks, My Speech at the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Late last year, he produced an article for Economic Policy Journal, The Big Short, an almost great movie. So let's bring him on board. Robert Wenzel, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, James. You're welcome.
All right, Robert, let's start getting into the nitty-gritty details and deconstructing this movie, what it gets right and what it gets wrong and what it misses out altogether. And I think that this is gestured at in your article, The Big Short, an almost great movie. Almost great, because it really is, I think, surprisingly a lot better than you would expect a mainstream Hollywood version of this story to be told. But, of course, as is to be expected, it doesn't get the story completely right. So, in your estimation, what is great about this movie, and what is not great about this movie?
James, I'll tell you what it did, and when it was right, it was phenomenally well done, just a great job. And what it showed is how these types of money managers, hedge fund managers, make decisions, what it's like when you're taking a big position against the mainstream and you're losing money short term and your investors are upset with you, and yet you see what's going on and what will occur eventually, and you just hold tough. So it's just great at showing how these decisions are made, the kind of homework that is necessary, and then how difficult it is from an emotional position to just hold on to these positions when the markets are trending against you short term. It's phenomenal as far as that's concerned. It's also very good at showing how difficult a game Wall Street is, because there will be people who will attempt to screw you one way or the other, and you just have to outthink them and figure out what possibilities might come at you and how to deal with them. And with that kind of stuff, I've never seen a movie like this. It's absolutely phenomenal at getting all that across.
I completely agree with that assessment. In fact, that was one of the things that struck me when I was watching this, is the idea that I hadn't really contemplated, but the idea that there are these people holding the credit default swaps, basically betting on the mortgages to default, but they have to hold on during the time when it is starting to fall apart, and yet at the same time, although the bond values are going down, they're being valued higher and higher. I mean, it's absolutely insanity what was going on at that time, and to hold that position as it looks like you're going to be completely wiped out, because you know on the other side of it you're going to win. It must be, I mean, I it's kind of strange to be sympathizing with the people who are betting on the end of the world as we know it, but that really is the position you get into in this movie.
Right, and I'll tell you what's really interesting is it shows how there will be other Wall Street players, traders, who will attempt to do things so that you can't profit if it's going to hurt them. And that's just part of the Wall Street game. So when I see these charges brought up on against traders for manipulating the LIBOR rate and all this kind of stuff, I just consider it minuscule stuff that goes on a daily basis. If people just understood how Wall Street worked, they would realize that's not a big deal. There's people on every side of a trade all the time. And they will do, especially if they've got serious money, they're very, very tough guys, and they will do whatever it takes to show a profit. And you have to just be smarter than them and figure out every angle and know how to protect yourself.
That's right. And I think the point, the movie does make that point when they point out, I think it was one Credit Suisse trader that ended up going to jail for hiding a few billion in bad mortgages, which, as the movie points out, most of the major banks were doing on a daily basis. So it's pretty arbitrary who ends up going to jail, or more to the point, you know, if you have power and influence, you don't go to jail.
Yeah, no question about that. And the thing that could, and it's not something that is necessary for the movie, but if people could just understand, this sort of happens in every market with every stock. I mean, they're just stuff. There's guys short, their market makers are short something. There are other people that are long, and people have different incentives to see different things go on. And on a short term basis, they'll do what they can. But in the long term, whatever trend is going on in the market, that's what will eventually develop, and this sort of stuff on a short-term basis is noise, but it's tough noise if you don't know what you're doing, and you can get killed if you don't know what you're doing.
Exactly right. Well, okay, so let's get into the other side of this then. It's an almost great movie because it doesn't quite go far enough. It leaves out a very, very important fundamental underlying point of how the markets arrived in the spot that they did to start creating these CDOs and synthetic CDOs and all these crazy instruments on top of these subprime mortgages. And that is, of course, the Federal Reserve, often excluded from economic and monetary thinking, although it should not be, obviously. Let's talk about the Fed and its role in creating the bubble of the mid-2000s.
Sure. The Federal Reserve was right there. There would have never been a bubble in the housing market if it wasn't for the Federal Reserve. And that's one thing that is just not made clear in the movie at all. It's just sort of blamed on the banking system and the types of mortgages that were made at the time. And it's true, there were a lot of sloppy mortgages, and the banking sector was probably sort of had in the back of their mind, well, if this all goes bad, the government will bail us out. I mean, that was sort of probably a deep back thought. But not all of Wall Street is bad. Not all of banking is bad. It's the funding of businesses is extremely important. The funding of new ventures, the funding of businesses that are expanding is extremely important. And it's not all evil. And that's the sense you get from this movie, is that all banks are bad, that they need to be regulated in a thousand different ways. And that's the problem. And that isn't the problem at all. The problem is the government bank, the Federal Reserve. Without the Federal Reserve pumping in money the way they did, the crisis would never have happened. And I happen to have, in real time in 2008, warned about the financial crisis that was developing. I got invited to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to discuss exactly how I saw it coming when the Federal Reserve didn't. And most interesting, in 2005, there were two New York Federal Reserve economists by the name of McCarthy and Peach who wrote a paper saying there is no housing bubble, when it was clear there was a housing bubble at that time. And I wrote a rebuttal to their paper, and I said they're making the greatest mistake since Irving Fisher in 1929 said stocks were at a new high plateau and they would never crash. And, you know, sure enough, it took a couple more years down the road, but the major trend came about, and the market in housing crashed, and it was clear there was a bubble. So you basically have a situation where that part of the movie, that story wasn't told. It wasn't told how the Fed was supporting it by their research, by the money they printed. And if that money wasn't printed, you have to ask yourself, how could you possibly have so many loans go out there in the subprime market and to people of questionable means to actually borrowing for mortgages? Where did this money come from? And it's very simple. The Federal Reserve created the money. And if they did not create the money, that would never crash would never have occurred. There would have never been such a bubble.
Right. Well, let's walk people through this, because we did get a lot of very simple explanations, I think, or easy to follow explanations of what was happening there in the subprime mortgage markets in the movie itself. But of course, we didn't get that breakdown of the Fed and how the Fed's rates control really the underlying basis for those markets. So let's walk people through that and talk about how the rates got down to where they were, why they were held there for so long, how that created the bubble, and then ultimately what resulted from that.
Yeah, it's not really as much the actual interest rate, because you can have periods when interest rates are way, way down like they are now, and you don't necessarily have a bubble and booming real estate market. You sort of have it coming back now from the crash, but it's still not at levels that it was prior to the crash when interest rates were a lot higher. So it's not the key isn't the interest rate level as much as it is how much money is the Federal Reserve pumping into the banking system, which allows the banking system to loan more money out. And the problem is, if the Fed could just print money forever, you could have a bubble forever. But the problem comes in that you start to get inflation heating up, prices are starting to climb, people are starting to get antsy about all that, and the Federal Reserve gets concerned, and they start slowing down the amount of money they're pumping in. And when they slow down that money, you don't have the same amount of money propping it all up, you're going to have a crash. It's sort of like a game of musical chairs. When the music's going around and there's enough chairs for everybody, that's fine. But if you take one chair away, you know, that's going to be a problem for someone. You take more chairs away, more problems. And with the Federal Reserve, what they do is they pump more money in and more money in and more money in, and then suddenly they slow down and stop printing the money, so it can't prop up all those mortgages that are out there. If somebody wants to sell, they can't find somebody who has new money to come in to buy it at the higher prices, and that's how you see the collapse.
Well, we know that since the collapse, the quantitative easing world has arisen, and we've got that reality where the Fed has been using that mechanism to pump money into the banks and to basically buy their toxic assets off of them. But what was the mechanism by which they were pumping money into the banking system before that point?
Yeah, essentially, the Federal Reserve uses three types of tools to control the money supply. They can control the interest rates. They can control what's known as the reserve requirement, how much banks are required to hold based upon the reserves they have. And then they do something called open market operations. Generally, what they've done with open market operations is they have bought treasury bills. So all I consider these quantitative easings is sort of a subset of the open market operations. They shifted a little bit, and they went to direct bailouts of the banksters, the major banks that were involved, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, people like that. And what they did is instead of just buying treasury securities, they went and they started buying securities that were held by the banks, the various mortgage securitization packages. And that's what caused what Bernanke called the quantitative easing or part of the quantitative easing. But it wasn't really a new tool. That's kind of misleading. And the Federal Reserve can do a lot of damage without ever doing another quantitative easing, but that's just sort of a subset of the general tools they use. And the most important one is, again, the open market operations, where the Federal Reserve, specifically the New York Federal Reserve Bank, operates a trading desk where they go and trade with primary dealers. Those are selected banks and other trading organizations, and they buy and sell securities. For the most part, they're buying or buying on net, and they generally tend to buy short-term securities. During this Bernanke period of quantitative easing, they bought long-term securities for a while, and then most important, they bought some of these securitized investments that the banks had. If people are looking, I see a lot of commentary out there saying, well, there's going to be another quantitative easing, or watch out for the next quantitative easing. The Fed can go in there and do all kinds of damage without announcing any other kind of quantitative easing. All they have to do is just go in and buy treasury bills like they do on a regular basis, and they can do a lot of damage.
Hard to represent that in a movie.
Right.
This is the underlying problem of the narrative.
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily had to go into that kind of detail, but they should have simply pinpointed that the Federal Reserve was printing money at that time. Because what they did, and they actually closed with this, is they showed pictures of different banks to really give, in bankers, there was a picture of Jamie Dimon, who's the head of J.P. Morgan Securities, J.P. Morgan Chase, and you know, he's one of the top banksters, and you know, he doesn't deserve a pass, but he's not the key element in the story. The key element is the Federal Reserve, and it's not banks. That's the sort of inaccurate impression that was given, that it was sort of all banks. That's the impression you're left with, that the banks were making these horrific mortgages, and that therefore we need controls on the banks. That's really not what was going on. It was the Federal Reserve providing all this money, and the bankers feeling comfortable that the Federal Reserve would come in to back them up if things went wrong, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, to the film's credit, I think the only mention that I could remember in the film from my viewing of government regulatory oversight or lack of oversight over the process itself was the mention of the woman who had left the SEC and gone directly into a job with the banks that she was supposedly regulating. So it certainly didn't seem that the movie was making an argument for regulation per se. It just wasn't really making the argument the way it perhaps should have been made.
Yeah, see, if you look at the movie right through to the end, the closing minutes are all about showing the banksters and really just giving that impression. And I saw it in a couple of reviews after the movie was out that's what people sort of the sense they got that, well, you know, if the banks are doing all this, making all these bad loans, then what we need to do is get in there and put some limitations on the banks so that they won't make these bad loans again. But that's not where the core problem is. The core problem is the Federal Reserve. And you can put all the restrictions on the banks you want as far as loaning out in the subprime market or different sectors. And the money's – if the Fed is printing money, it's going out there somewhere. It may not be in that sector, but you have to stop the Federal Reserve from printing the money. That's really the key and the problem.
But also at the end of the movie, Mark Baum comes to the realization that of the moral hazard argument that they did it because they knew they would be bailed out at taxpayer expense. They didn't care. They were just, you know. So I think it was obviously, I mean, a question of, yes, greed, but also the underlying part of that is the fact they knew the government would not let them fail.
Right, right. Of course, that is true in general, but it didn't work for Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns.
Right.
And for Lehman Brothers, it was just a case where I think the people at Lehman Brothers, the top personnel, were people that sort of were being kicked out of the insider club, and they were sort of taken down. As a matter of fact, when Lehman Brothers went down and then Bear Stearns went down, after those two went down, the next one that looked like it had trouble was going to be Citigroup. And I wrote at economicpolicyjournal.com, my website, that now there will be a bailout. There's no way they're letting Citigroup down.
Yeah.
And of course, that's what they protected.
Wasn't Citigroup from the ashes of National City Bank back in the day?
From the old days.
Right.
Yeah. But the key really was that Robert Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary in the Clinton administration, was at that point running the bank as co-chairman or some position. It appeared he didn't really want the position, but he was kind of pushed into it. And then there's a famous call he made to Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke that showed up on Ben Bernanke's phone logs, and Rubin claimed that he was just calling Bernanke to tell him he was doing a great job. So there you go.
It would be funny, I suppose, if it wasn't trillions of dollars of wealth and people being homeless at the end of it.
Right.
Well, let's be optimistic then. Let's say that there are people out there, and I'm sure there are, who have seen this movie and are appalled or re-appalled at what happened and are looking for more answers about this and about what fundamentally is underlying this. I note that in your article, The Big Short, an Almost Great Movie, you start by saying that in addition to recommending this movie to people to see, you will also recommend they read Street Fighting at Wall and Abroad, an insider's tale of stock manipulation, and The Professional Commodity Trader, along with Peter Lynch books. Can you tell us about those resources?
Sure. Those are specifically aimed at people who sort of want to get involved in Wall Street. Those books are about how stocks are, to use a better word, manipulated. It's more of for someone that really wants to look at the insider game. That's not going to give you the big picture stuff. My book, The Fed Flunks, where I give the speech at the Federal Reserve and also report in there how I in real time on my economicpolicyjournal.com blog warned about the crisis that was developing, tends to give you more of a bigger picture. From there, you're getting into more technical books. There's a great book by Murray Rothbard, although it doesn't cover quantitative easing. It was written in the 80s, called The Mystery of Banking, which is excellent in explaining how the Federal Reserve actually pumps money into the system. So that's a really, really good book. One thing I would add, the the surprises generally come in directions that most people don't expect. So people, everybody was buying into the mortgage market. I'd written pieces for a couple of years before the crash saying, I can't believe this. I was in a pizza shop and, you know, guys were exchanging stories about how they're going to put on a second and third mortgage and then sell it and buy a new house. And I said, oh, you know, all these guys are going to lose and all that kind of stuff. But at that time, you couldn't talk to these people and tell them, say, look, watch out, the danger is there. Now the problem is, and there are very, very few people that believe this, that there's going to be a major new accelerating inflation that I see. And that's where you really have to pay attention. That's where the next danger is going to be, which means, you know, the old inflation hedges, sort of like gold and silver and things like that, are very, very important to have at that time, when that inflation starts to develop. It was interesting that just this last week, gold closed up one day $65 an ounce, which is really a remarkable spike. And I don't think that's the last time we're going to see spikes of that size in gold. It might not happen right away, but maybe 6 months to 12 months down the road.
You mentioned the Fed flux and your speech at the Federal Reserve Bank, but people may not know the story of that. How did that come about? How did you get to speak at the New York Fed, and what did you tell them?
Yeah, well, that was kind of interesting because what happened, these two economists wrote a book in 2005, Why There Is No Housing Bubble, or There Is No Housing Bubble. And I replied to them at that time that there was. I wrote a paper, and they actually And I did say they're making the biggest mistake since Irving Fisher in 1929. And they actually went around the country when they were telling their story and showing us a slide of my quote saying, calling in an opposing view. And I'm sure they got a lot of snickers at the time when I said they were making the biggest mistake. So then what happened is the Federal Reserve, after the financial crisis, came out and named a couple of economists that sort of warned about the thing. And I contacted them and said, you know, why don't you, you know, you should note that I'm in that group. Here it is in real time throughout. Not only did I issue the rebuttal to paper saying there was no housing bubble, but I called the exact timing of it in the summer of 2008, and I said you should, you know, mention me the next time you're identifying economists that called it, because I nailed it pretty well. And then I actually started a conversation with Richard Peach, who was one of the economists that wrote There Is No Housing Bubble. And at some point he said to me, he said, well, why don't you come on over and you know, give us a little talk on you know, how you saw this coming and the differences between your view and what we saw. So I said, sure. And he sent out a notice to all the economists at the Federal Reserve. And I thought to myself, wow, I mean, you know, I don't think they realize how big a critic of the Federal Reserve I am. And sure enough, within a few hours, it was canceled. But then Richard Peach is a great guy to contact me. Don't worry, we're still going to have you speak and all that kind of stuff. We just had to do it a different way. And so I wasn't sure until I got into the Federal Reserve whether that I was actually going to give the speech. And but it, once I was in, if I had to give it in the men's bathroom at the Federal Reserve, I was going to do it. And you have to go through like two or three security checks. And then Peach came down and he had about three tables reserved, looked like for possibly as many as 36 people. And he told me most of them were going to be late, which really didn't surprise me. And he came down and a couple of other guys, and that was it. There was just a couple of us there. And so I told him, I says, look, you know, I prepared this speech and I'm going to deliver it here. And I did. And we actually had a really good conversation after that, and I really learned how narrow a view they have of how the economy works. my perspective comes from what's known as the Austrian School of Economics, which Friedrich Hayek was a member, and he received the Nobel Prize for his work in business cycle theory, which is what I used to predict the 2008 financial crash. And they really were not familiar with his work at all, which really, really surprised me. I mean, Austrians all know about the Keynesian theories that the Federal Reserve operates under, but they seem to have very, very little understanding of what Austrians think. And that might have been part of the problem. Now, I have interestingly enough, this weekend I put up a piece where it appears that one of the New York Federal Reserve economists plagiarized work by Murray Rothbard, who's another great Austrian economist, and they sort of stated some of his views without making it clear that they got it from him. And there was an economist who went through, an Austrian, who went through in sort of detail and said, here, look, this is what Murray Rothbard wrote. Here's what they wrote. So I'm glad, plagiarism or not, I'm glad that they're sort of taking a look at the Austrian and understand that, you know, we sort of have a pretty good theory as far as how the business cycle works.
So I guess the real question, although it may be a rhetorical one, is why was the movie not based on yourself and your story rather than Michael Burry? And the other question, I guess, who would play you in the movie?
Yeah, well, that would have to be who would play me in a movie. I'd have to, you know, I don't know who the...
Tom Cruise, maybe. Director. I don't know.
Who's that?
Tom Cruise, maybe.
Tom Cruise, all right. I like that. I could go with that. They probably just weren't familiar with me. I mean, Michael Lewis wrote the book and that the movie was based on, and he really... He probably has a lot of Wall Street contacts that knew Burry, and that's how that sort of thing got going. So that might be one explanation. And then there's also, I actually published a paper at Economic Policy Journal by a gal who sort of wrote something negative about Michael Lewis. So Michael Lewis probably was not too excited about
promoting
my site.
Right. Okay, let's talk then about Economic Policy Journal and the work that you do there.
Okay, great. EconomicPolicyJournal.com is a website where I post different commentary on the economy from an Austrian school perspective, which sometimes works with regard to free market economics, in regard to the business cycle, which is specifically an Austrian theory. And I talk about different things that are going on in the world and what might develop. I also cover different personalities in the economic movement. I cover some of the major players that are sort of anti-Austrian, such as the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. And I like to think I destroy some of his terrible arguments. And so we have a lot of fun, and also I'm pretty tough even on Austrians. There's a bunch of them I'm calling Austrian lights right now, because they sort of hold this view that the economy is always going down, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. The Austrian school business cycle theory is a boom bust cycle. So yeah, by the Federal Reserve manipulating money supply, there is a bust, but there are times when there's a boom, and I think to a large degree that's being ignored right now. And, you know, unemployment is way down. It was as high as over 10% a couple of years ago. Now it's below 5%. You can argue whether that number is manipulated a little bit by the Bureau of Labor Statistics or not. And I don't doubt that the government can and does manipulate numbers at some time, but I don't really see a specific reason for them to do it at this time with regard to that. And I'm here in based in San Francisco, and I see the boom around here, and I see some people raising incredible amounts of money that you would never see in a bust period. There's money out here that is absolutely tremendous. You see it in the real estate market here, and you also see it in New York and a couple of other parts of the country. So the money is being funneled, the Federal Reserve money is being funneled into sort of specific geographic regions, and this is one of them. And this is not what the bus period is going to be like. The bus period, when it comes, I mean, it's going to be real bad. It may not be for another couple of years or maybe even longer, but when it comes, you're going to have a crash like you wouldn't believe the next time around. My landlord, where I rent space from, I've got a nice space here in a new building that was just constructed last year. And I told him, I says, do you realize, you know, your model here with they're renting mostly to high tech companies. I said, these companies are not going to survive. They're basically, surviving on money printed by the Fed. They're not making any money and they just keep on going back and back to the markets. So I said, when this is over, these people are not going to be able to afford these rents. You're going to have 80% of the building empty. I'm going to be one of the very few that's going to be able to afford to stay here, and maybe two or three others. I pointed out some names to him. I said, what I'm paying now for my space, I'm going to take half a floor, and you're going to be glad I'm paying you that for half a floor. So that's what the next downturn is going to look like. This is not a downturn now. It's a boom bust cycle, and we are in a significant boom. And the warning is, because we haven't had significant price inflation, it's been just under 2%, that most people just do not think it's going to come back. But once the oil price stops to fall, and really what's interesting is the Federal Reserve has even said this, they just don't realize how big the inflation is that's going to come back. But they have stated clearly in their forecast, and when they go out and give speeches, Janet Yellen, who's the Fed chairman, and the Federal Reserve Vice Chairman Stanley Fisher have made clear. They say, you know, all that has to happen is for the oil price to stabilize, and you're going to start to see the overall price inflation numbers uptick. And they're absolutely true about that. But the problem is they don't realize how quickly inflation can kick up. They're at a point where they think it may go to 2%. I was here recently at a conference where the San Francisco Federal Reserve President John Williams was here. I said, well, what if inflation ticks up higher to 3%? Will you consider that sort of too hot? Will you start pulling in the reins on things? And he said, well, it depends upon the other numbers and environment at that time. And it's kind of what I expected him to say. And what's going to happen is inflation's going to go, their target is 2%. And it's going to go to 3%, and they're going to say, well, it's because the oil price is now going up a little bit, so it can go up a little bit on the high side, and it's no big deal. So they're not going to worry about it till 3%, until it's over 3%. It'll get to 5%. Then they're going to start worrying about it. But in order to fight inflation at 5%, you have to raise interest rates above 5%. Now, these are interest rates that they had from 0 to 0.25% that they've now raised from 0.25% to 0.5%. They are not suddenly going to raise rates to 6 or 7% to battle the 5% inflation. So inflation is going to get away from them and climb even higher. You don't know where it's going to stop, but I just see a major, major problem coming down the road, and very, very, very few people see it. They're all talking about rates going down from here. You never know what's going to happen in the short term, especially with the oil price going down. But looking out, not that far, 6 months, 12 months, you're going to start to see the inflation bubble start to develop. And it's very, very interesting how strongly gold reacted this week. And what's also interesting is the first time in a long time you saw the dollar drop against many, many currencies. Up until now, whenever oil went down, the dollar was going up because you really had a lot of these oil-producing countries scrambling to get dollars to pay the dollar debts and all that kind of stuff. But there must be so much dollar overhang around the globe, and given the amount of money that's printed, that doesn't surprise me, that even with the dollar dropping, and you've got countries from Saudi Arabia to Russia to Venezuela scrambling for dollars to pay their debt because they're not getting it. These are top oil producing companies, and they're not generating it by selling oil. Despite them scrambling for dollars, you're starting to see the dollar weaken, which is really, really a serious sign. Because when that dollar breaks in starts to fall in foreign exchange markets, that's going to put additional pressure on price inflation here in the United States. So I expect it just coming from the domestic side, but when you add dollar weakness on top of it, watch out.
Well, I think we'll have to keep our eye on that, and hopefully people will be keeping their eye on economicpolicyjournal.com, where you'll, I'm sure, have the ringside seat and be in the catbird seat looking out for that. But in the meantime, let's put a bow on this conversation. In the Fed flunks, of course, you gave the Federal Reserve an F on their report card. What about your report card for The Big Short? If you had to give it an A to F, what would you give it?
That's a really tricky question. I would say... The error they made was a serious error in not bringing the Federal Reserve in, and sort of gave people a bad direction. So I have to say, because of that, an overall a B minus, but for explanation of how hedge fund managers and money managers work and all that, I mean, that's an A plus. Let's put it this way. I would grade it in two ways. An A plus for that part of it. What was going on as far as the how money managers invest his work? It's just brilliant as far as that's concerned. And the tension that develops and how difficult it is from an emotional perspective to keep those investments going. But an F for the long term message, because they just did not deliver that properly. It gives a wrong message that the problem is with the banks and that just regulation of the banks will solve the problem. But as long as you have the Federal Reserve printing money, that money's going to get out there somewhere and it will find the place that's not regulated, and you'll get the next boom and it'll surprise everyone.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Robert Wenzel, economicpolicyjournal.com. Thank you very much for your time.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you, James.
All right, friends, that's going to do it for today. But before we put a bow on today's conversation and tell you what you need to be reading up in order to study ahead for next month's edition of this series, first of all, as always, let's turn back a month and take a look through the comment section on the previous edition of this podcast at CorbettReport.com, namely FLNWO number 31 on the Manchurian Candidate with Tim Kelly of the Our Interesting Times podcast. A lot of interesting comments in the comment section, as always, including a few recommendations that I can't necessarily vouch for myself as I haven't read or seen them, but we had, for example, a Render review recommending the Our Brand is Crisis documentary, not the film, the documentary, to talk about the manufacturing of the consent of the electorate. We had Nanza Momish recommending the Bangkok Asset by John Burdett, who apparently name drops MK Ultra in the acknowledgments of the book. And we have Kukulin recommending The Quiet American by Graham Greene. The book by Graham Greene, of course, then made into a movie with the help of the CIA, which, as Kukulin points out, pretty much inverted the meaning of the book itself, which is an interesting point. And I have read the book and seen the movie, but it's been a pretty long time since I've done either, so it might be good to revisit that and might be a good future candidate for this series itself. There was also some comments in, for example, from Ralph O. Davis, who writes to say this, the Manchurian Candidate, may be the original limited hangout submission by the MSCIA Hollywood. Manufacturing consent for mind control tech has been relentless since with massive proliferation of carrier wave transmission, and he goes on to recommend an interview with Dr. John Hall. We had MP Radio write in to say, "Hi, James, I greatly enjoyed this discussion, especially toward the end when you touched on the possibility that even the sincere alternative media might be playing some kind of role in the big plan. I wondered that myself and continued pondering it actively for a few days after listening to this. Then, as luck would have it, while listening to you and James Evan Pilato talking about Davos and robotics, a thought occurred to me that might connect the dots. You pointed out that the population reduction phase of the big plan might become imminent if the masses were not even needed as carriers of water, to quote the report from Iron Mountain. Given that war is the best way to reduce the population, world war, civil war, etc., perhaps feeding into the alternative narrative gives the planners a third front, in addition to the East-West conflict that seems to be brewing, of self-identified nonconformists, think the Great Leap Forward, against whom to fight, and our job in the alternative media is to get that group ready for battle. Obama's brilliant program of getting as many guns and ammo into the hands of this self-selected group could also play into this. Love it when you peel that extra layer of the onion." Very interesting comment, and I think that is an apt observation, which is why I think it's always incumbent on the alternative media not to denigrate or put down or belittle people who have different points of view or haven't woken from conditioning, mainstream conditioning yet, because, again, if we dehumanize and distance ourselves from that group, it does set up the Civil War-type narrative that you're talking about there, and I think that is part of a long-term plan. I mean, again, I think social engineers are not stupid, and they understand where this narrative heads. And as long as they can push it to a head and make these crazy prepper people go crazy and start shooting people and whatever, then they win that game, that narrative, because then they can come in and crack down on it. So I think it is important to think about how the alternative media, to the extent that it advocates violence and bloodshed, is exactly playing into the hands of that that paradigm. So some good food for thought there. And also, J.P. Sousa 67 leaves an interesting comment. What are we to make of the references to Abraham Lincoln in the form of the stepfather's costume and the bust in his office? Is this simply a foreshadowing of his impending assassination, or is it an indication that mind control assassins may be a much older tool of the political class than is typically thought? An interesting observation. I must admit, I saw the Abraham Lincoln costume, and I did not really think about it. I didn't ponder it, but yes, I mean, I think perhaps both of those possibilities might be true, a foreshadowing of the assassination, but also, yes, the idea that, well, this game of, you know, mind control assassination may be much older than we originally thought. So an interesting comment there. Thank you for bringing that up. And finally, in the comments from last month, we had a comment, I guess, presaging this conversation on The Big Short from Zafanis, who writes, hi, James, I want to thank you for all the hard work you've given us. I just saw the movie The Big Short and was fortunate enough to enjoy it with some family. I found it really informative and enjoyable, especially near the end, where the narrator explained all the would-be financial reforms that happened because of the housing bubble. I almost started booing out loud and throwing popcorn at the screen because we know that nothing was done, but then the narrator said, just kidding. So he goes on to talk about having seen this movie with a few of his friends, including a newly graduated economist, a self-made conspiracy theorist, a CNN viewer, and an introvertive peace seeker. And he said, I found myself having a conversation for just a few minutes with the conspiracy theorist and the economist. We all could agree that one of the best aspects of this movie is that it brought these issues to the big screen, and hopefully more people will be talking about them. I wonder if this type of movie is just given to us in order for us to feel better about the economic issues that are happening. I remember listening about a human reaction that just by listening or being aware of the problem, it would make us feel better about ourselves and would probably discourage us from taking any other actions. I'd love to hear your comments on this movie. Also, I read several comments from subscribers in your website. I have to admit, it was intimidating writing something that would not be up to the grammar or philosophical standards upheld by your subscribers. You have been an inspiration, and I continue. I hope you continue your much appreciated work. Well, thank you for that comment, Zafanis. Trust me, I'm not going to denigrate anyone for improper grammar or not the deepest philosophical insights. Please do leave your comments and reactions in the comment section. I think it is a vital part of what we're doing here as people interact and hopefully, again, as I like to say, learn our way forward together with providing new insights and ideas and links and other things in this open source community. So please do get your comments in. If you like The Big Short, if you hated it, if you thought we missed something out of this conversation, leave your comments in the comment section of this post on CorbettReport.com, and I'll go over them at the end of next month. Speaking of next month, here is the point you've all been waiting for. Drumroll, please. What are we going to be talking about next month? We're going to be talking about the sci-fi classic from Robert Heinlein, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And as always, if you don't know about that book, I will include a link in the show notes so that you can, get your copy and get started reading. So good luck. I'll talk to you again on this podcast next month, and hopefully a lot sooner on CorbettReport.com.